For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as in a cave. We invite you now to join us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle, Timothy O'Donnell, and Joseph Tomasian. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
And welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here, solo this week. And, you know, it's January, it's cold. And for a lot of us, cold in January bring back fond memories of multiple marches for life. Marches for Life in Washington, D.C. Marches for Life here in Indiana. We'll be having the annual Indiana March for Life on Monday, January 22nd, so that's still coming up. And, you know, it's been asked, why does the March for Life have to always happen in the freezing cold of January? And that's because it's marking the anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision. So the Roe versus Wade decision is the Supreme Court decision that overturned all of the abortion laws in the country in 1973, and it led into an era that lasted 50 years of unregulated, for the most part, abortion. For really, Roe versus Wade came into effect with a companion case, Doe versus Bolton, that was down in Georgia. And so those two worked together that it really opened up this era where initially states did not have the right to regulate abortion, and abortion was allowed pretty much on demand throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. Over the years, there were other court cases that kind of allowed states to have more say on that. And so, you know, the Webster decision allowed states, I think, to look at parental notice, parental notification. The Casey decision allowed states to really regulate abortion starting in the last trimester. But really, up until the Dobbs decision, abortion was allowed and states were not allowed to outlaw it. And then everything changed. The Dobbs decision came down and states were suddenly allowed to pass any laws really regarding abortion that they wanted. There have been a couple of challenges here and there. The big battle has been at the state level, because the Dobbs decision decided basically that abortion, there's no constitutional right to abortion written in the federal constitution. But the question came up, what about the state constitution? So here in Indiana, Our legislature was kind of primed and ready for the Dobbs decision to come down. So once the Dobbs decision came down, the governor called a special session. And that special session then went about creating our current abortion law that's in effect now. And it was immediately challenged. And that challenge had to go to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court had to look at our state constitution. And after they looked at it, they said, no, you know, there's really no constitutional right to an abortion in the state constitution. So our law was allowed to stand. Other states have looked at that, Kansas being the most notable, and have said, no, you know, there is a constitutional right to abortion. The citizens of Kansas tried to challenge that and failed, unfortunately. They tried to put an amendment in and failed in that endeavor. And so other states have been looking at that, and there's been a lot of activity state to state. But we're now in a new era when it comes to abortion, particularly here in Indiana. So those of us that have been involved in the pro-life movement, and, you know, I'm president of Right to Life of Indianapolis in my day job. I'm co-host of the Catholic Cave as sort of a side gig to a certain extent. And as president of Right to Life of Indianapolis, I've realized, and I think most of the people in the pro-life movement have realized, that Roe versus Wade was a huge obstacle. It was a roadblock in our way to being able to protect human life from conception to natural death. It also, in a lot of ways, stunted the cultural development of our country. And I want to come back to this and talk about this in a little bit, of how abortion has really stunted our development as a society when it comes to taking care of women and children. But Roe versus Wade was an obstacle, but it was never the final goal. The final goal has to be, and always was, creating a culture of life where abortion's not only unavailable, but it's really unthinkable. It's one of those relics of the past that we'll look back on in 100 years and go, how on earth did we ever think that this was something moral to do? Somewhat like slavery. We just got past the anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King Jr., who brought about an end to segregation. Segregation, of course, was part of that cultural aftermath of slavery that lasted another 100 years after slavery was outlawed. And I think, you know, in some ways, there's an analogy here between abortion and slavery, segregation, civil rights, etc. We're still dealing in our culture with the aftermath of slavery. There was no way our country was going to be able to enslave a race of people, keep them largely uneducated, keep them largely tied to manual labor. There was no way we were going to be able to do that and then suddenly end it and have there be no continued consequences, no momentum from that, no continuing to need to deal with repairing the damage that we had done, repairing human relationships, repairing the fabric of our society. And that process has lasted, in the case of slavery, well over 100 years now, probably close to 150 years. And there's no doubt that we're still dealing with the fallout from the evil of slavery. Abortion, I feel, is going to be very similar. We're going to have to be dealing with the aftermath of abortion long after it's been completely outlawed. And we're not even there yet. In Indiana, we were able to pass a law that has gotten rid of the idea of standalone abortion facilities. It's restricted abortion to only hospitals. And most importantly, it's restricted abortion legally to cases of rape and incest, cases where the life of the mother is in danger, and cases of fatal fetal anomaly. Those cases, I think we need to kind of readdress as a society and say, look, is there a way we can do better than abortion even in these cases? Human life is human life. And we as Catholics recognize the sacredness of human life from the moment of conception. And I think that's part of why Catholics have led the charge on this fight against abortion. But I think it's also why Catholics are going to have to continue to play a role in building this culture of life, because our understanding of the sanctity of human life really gives us a standpoint from which to move forward. It does make a unique understanding of who the human person is, who we are as human beings, and then from that, what the goal of life is, what's the purpose of life. And once we have that established, what the purpose of life is, then we can start to understand what a just society looks like, what it is that a society is supposed to do, is supposed to promote, and is supposed to keep from happening in our human lives. So we as Catholics have a tremendous role to play in the public sphere, not only on the abortion issue, but other issues. But I think our main focus right now as Catholics, and our bishops have in a lot of ways led the way on this, has to be addressing the reestablishment of the sanctity of human life as a core principle of our country. So we're going to take a quick break here on the Catholic Cave. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about a culture of life. What does it mean to build a culture of life? What does that culture of life look like? And why is it kind of incumbent on us as Catholics to lead the way in creating the culture of life? You're listening to the Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy. We'll be right back.
If you have had an abortion in your past, if you're feeling sad or angry, if you cry often and for no reason, if you feel like your life is out of control, please consider talking with Debbie Miller and Healing Hidden Hurts Ministry. She offers free, confidential, one-to-one ministry for women who are post-abortion. Debbie has been there and has 17 years of experience helping women find peace once again. She can be reached at 317-490-1267 or online at healinghiddenhurts.org.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, and we are talking about the sanctity of life today. Sanctity of Life Sunday is coming up next week as I'm recording this. And the March for Life, the annual March for Life, will be in Washington, D.C. on Friday, January 19th. And our Indiana State March for Life will be on Monday, January 22nd, downtown. So come, join us. Take a stand for human life. And this will be the 50th March for Life in Washington, D.C. The Marches for Life started in 1974, right after the Roe versus Wade decision, the year after. So this will be the 50th anniversary of that. And it is also really about the second anniversary after the Dobbs decision came down. So we're now in a new era of abortion rights. States now have the right to regulate and outlaw abortion if the state so chooses. And the question I think a lot of people have is, okay, if the Dobbs decision came down, if Roe versus Wade is overturned, why are you still marching on January 22nd? And I think there's a few different reasons for that. One of them is Memorial, right? After the Roe versus Wade decision came down, there were approximately 65 million abortions that happened in this country over the next 50 years. So that's 65 million individual human beings. It's hard to get our minds wrapped around what a number like 65 million is. So, I mean, here in Indianapolis, our metroplex is a little bit over a million people. So, if you think of maybe 60, maybe 50, 60 Indianapolises, and all of the people that are in Indianapolis, including Carmel, the surrounding areas, them wiped out, and then 50 more cities the size of Indianapolis wiped out as well. That's the number of human individuals who have been aborted. Now, of course, we never saw them. We never knew them. A lot of times we never even knew about their existence. And on the one hand, there's maybe a little bit of a comfort in that. An abortion is a tragic occurrence, but because you don't have that sort of social recognition of this child, a lot of times I think the emotional trauma may be less than the death of a person that's been on this earth for a while. But on the other hand, the tragedy is compounded by that because there's so much lost potential, in the loss of each and every individual human life. And so I think that loss of potential is partly why we march on January 22nd, just to recognize that 65 million human individuals have been lost. And that's a tremendous, tremendous blow to our society. You know, I try often to sit back and think about what would Indianapolis be like if we had never had abortion, if there had never been, the abortion facilities that were here. And if every pregnant mom, if every child was welcome, if every pregnant mom had the help that she needed, and the support that she needed to be able to be a mom, to be able to successfully raise a kid, what would Indianapolis look like? And, there's a lot packed into that because I think you have to peel back where abortion came from, what abortion was reacting to, because abortion didn't come out of a vacuum. It wasn't like in 1973, you had this Roe versus Wade decision and suddenly abortion was just boom here in the United States. Abortion has been a perennial issue and in some ways a part of the American fabric for longer than the 50 years that it's been legalized. But where it came from and why this push to legalize it and why this massive increase in its use, that's a question that we've got to get deeper into sort of some cultural, I guess, failures on our part as our country evolved from being mostly an agrarian society to being an urban society that we are now. And there was a lot that a lot of issues and a lot of problems that came to the fore, that abortion was foisted on us to a certain extent as the solution to those problems, as a bad solution to those problems. And because of that, those problems haven't gone away, right? Just because we've made abortion illegal doesn't mean that women are getting the support that they need. It doesn't mean that children are welcomed into, you know, a family the way they ought to be. And it doesn't mean that our society is able to be there for women that need help, for the moms that might need help, for our families. Our society is deeply wounded, partly because of abortion, but partly those wounds existed prior to abortion, and abortion was kind of given to us as the solution for some of these problems. So, you know, we've talked about needing to build a culture of life in the pro-life movement, and that's been a mantra of ours for a while. And the question comes up, what does a culture of life look like? What does it mean? And part of that is visualizing, okay, what would Indianapolis look like if we didn't have abortion? But part of it's also going back and peeling back those sort of cultural causes of abortion. So I want to talk about the two big strains that led to abortion, and then talk a little bit about, okay, what does it look like to start wrestling with these problems? Because I think abortion has stunted our development in trying to address some of these problems and some of these issues. It's kind of similar to the contraceptive pill, right? John Paul II Institute has done a tremendous amount of research on female fertility. It's done a tremendous amount of research on natural fertility, fertility awareness, and being able to help cure women of a lot of gynecological issues. And they've been able to kind of pave the way and do that because the rest of the medical community has been hiding behind the birth control pill for generations. So when a woman would come in with a set of gynecological problems, very often what would happen is she'd be put on the birth control pill, right? So, you know, a heavy period or painful periods or any number of issues like that were simply masked and covered up by giving a woman the birth control pill. And what it did, it stunted medical development of being able to find the medical reasons for a lot of these problems and being able then to find cures and solutions and ways to really heal women and really help, honestly, treat women not as just sort of having a problem that can be masked, but as a way to actually bring their whole body to a state of healing. Abortion's been similar in our culture. You know, we've had issues and problems that abortion has tried to address. It's addressed them very badly, and in the course of covering up these problems, sometimes it's made these problems worse. It's also created new problems. So now as we're moving into a phase where we can start to talk about making abortion unthinkable, the first step to making abortion unthinkable is really getting to the root causes that abortion was claiming to address, kind of figuring out where abortion came from and why it was that women felt this need to have an abortion. You know, the founder of Feminists for Life, Frederica Matthews Green, I think her quote on what it is that compelled women to want and need abortions is incredibly poignant. She said, you know, women never wanted abortion and never want abortion the way somebody wants an ice cream cone or a Porsche. Women want an abortion the way an animal wants to gnaw its leg off to be able to get out of a trap. And so I think with that in mind, you know, we need to start looking back at what is it about our culture that makes women feel trapped by pregnancy? What is it that becomes almost debilitating for certain moms in our culture to be pregnant? You know, the stereotype of the woman taking the pregnancy test and her heart just sinking as she sees that positive result. If you look at it from a theological viewpoint, if you look at it from a big picture viewpoint, this should be the most joyous experience in any person's life of cooperating with God to bring into existence a new human being. I mean, that's a tremendous privilege, a tremendous honor, and a tremendous moment of grace. And the fact that it is such a moment of terror for so many people in our culture shows a huge failure on our part in multiple ways. So we're going to take another break. And after the break, we're going to come back. And I want to talk about two strands that have really led to this culture of death, as John Paul II talked about it, and what it is we need to do to really restore a culture of life in our culture. You've been listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Walk on. No worries. Be renewed. Be refreshed. Care deeply. Don't miss life. Positive change is on the way. Catholic Radio Indy.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here on a cold, freezing cold January morning. And we are recording just really days before Sanctity of Life Sunday and the annual March for Life that's going to be in Washington, D.C., and then the Indiana March for Life that will be here in Indiana on January 22nd, commemorating the Roe versus Wade decision and memorializing the huge loss of life that abortion has meant for our culture. Last segment, I was talking about abortion being kind of a mask for cultural problems that had existed, and it was supposed to be a solution, right? People didn't buy into abortion because they somehow thought that destroying unborn life was a good idea. They bought into abortion because they thought that this was the only choice available for certain women in our culture. And I think we as pro-lifers have to kind of step back and go, okay, why and how did we get to that point? And it didn't happen in a vacuum. I think there's several cultural forces. I think two of the biggest ones, though, and two of the ones that we really have to reckon with go way, way back, probably over 150 years. And those are the feminist movement, which by and large was a positive movement in our culture, even though it did kind of culminate in abortion, and the feminists looked to abortion as a solution for a lot of what they were trying to achieve. This movement towards equal dignity for women within our culture was a positive move, and it was a necessary move when you go back into, the 1850s, 1860s. The other cultural phenomenon that abortion came out of was the eugenics movement. And this was a poisonous movement within our society that came out of slavery. So, I started talking about the analogy of slavery and the civil rights movement and segregation, and how even after slavery was outlawed at the end of the Civil War, you still had a period of fallout for 100 years where Jim Crow was put into effect. There was segregation within our society. The black population was seen as second class citizens, and we had segregation of water fountains, of swimming pools, of schools, of institutions. That went on for another 100 years after slavery, and we're still trying to unravel the damage that was caused in our society by both slavery and then segregation afterwards. Abortion is going to be the same way. Even after we have made abortion completely unthinkable and we're looking at abortion as this relic of the past, we're going to have to unpack the fallout from it. But the connection between abortion and slavery goes deeper than that, because the eugenics movement in our culture came out of slavery. We had kept an entire race of people enslaved. We had kept them largely uneducated. We had kept them largely confined to manual labor. So any development of medicine, any development of science, any development of technology, we segregated that, and we left that as a whites only project. And so with that, society kind of looked and said, okay, now that we've freed the slaves, what do we do with these people that we've intentionally kept uneducated and for the most part fit for manual labor. And so the first idea out of the cage was, well, why don't we create a colony back in Africa and we can try to repatriate them back to Africa. And so Liberia was founded, and some of the former slaves did go and they colonized Liberia, but it certainly was not going to be a long-term solution, nor was that a really intelligent idea, nor was it a just solution for that matter, because, you know, the African Americans that we had brought here as slaves, they were now part of America. They had no ties to Africa, and to send them back was an act of cruelty in a lot of ways. So after that, the idea dawned on some people, well, why don't we try to selectively breed the black element out of our society? And so eugenics started. And eugenics started not only with African Americans, but also with anybody that was seen as deficient. So eugenics was pushed to try to alleviate diseases. It was pushed to try to alleviate those that were seen as feeble-minded. It was pushed to try to purify our race. And those racial overtones carried on into Europe. And the ultimate culmination of eugenics was the Nazi movement, where they tried to exterminate an entire race and multiple races of people and people that they saw deficient really in any way. Well, that whole strain of thought had started here in America, and it was exported to Germany. So it persisted here in America, and it culminated in the idea of, if we can utilize birth control to try to have less births from those we find undesirable and more births from those we find desirable, then we can eventually improve our race. We can eventually improve the stock, the American stock, as it came to be known. And, we can solve our problem that way. So, you know, this is just a pernicious, awful way of thinking, because it misses the dignity of every human being as a creature of God, as somebody that has been created in that image and likeness of God. And it makes human worth dependent on what their value is to society. So it says some people are less desirable because they're less desirable to society. And those that are less desirable to society, we need to gradually erase and get rid of. That idea still persists. It has not gone away. It's still a strong part of American society. We have a tremendous number of people that are seen as not contributing to society in some way. And so therefore they are seen as human beings with less dignity, human beings that we can treat as lesser, human beings that we can look at and say, well, you're not really my brother, you're not really my sister. And so, you know, we have a tremendous amount of, I think, reparation to do as Catholics to restore that idea that every single human being is created in the image and likeness of God. And that goes beyond just the abortion front. But that eugenics movement took over not only, I think, as a cultural movement, it began to affect our policies. And with those policies, we began to start flirting with things like sterilizations of those that we saw as either criminal or those that we saw as mentally deficient in some way. And also, unfortunately, there was the idea to sterilize the black race wholeheartedly. So that idea came about. Margaret Sanger was a nurse in New York City. She was married to a socialist. And as these ideas of how to improve, I think, the stock of children came about, she got the connection and she said, look, this would be a tremendous help for the working class. If they can control the number of children they have, we can have fewer unfit children, we can have fewer children who are unwanted, and we can have more of the better type of children. And so she started really pushing for birth control and the legalization of birth control. She established a birth control clinic in New York City, quickly was arrested for that, because at the time the dissemination of information about birth control was illegal. She kind of was an early pioneer of civil disobedience, went ahead and did that anyway, held large-scale conferences and seminars to try to teach people about contraception. And she really spearheaded this idea of birth control as a eugenic instrument. And that eugenic mentality behind birth control continued to persist up until when abortion became legalized. We're going to take a quick break, and I want to talk about how that began to mesh with the feminist movement, and how that introduction of birth control within to the feminist world really perverted feminism and led to the era of abortion that started with Roe versus Wade. You're listening to The Catholic Cave here on Catholic Radio Indy.
You've just found out you're pregnant. Your life is not the same. You may be feeling alone and frightened. You're faced with so many decisions. Right now, you need a friend, someone you can depend on and trust, someone who will listen to you and support you, someone who will stand by you. Let us be there for you. I'm Linda Kyle with the Great Lakes Gabriel Project, and we're here to help. Give us a call at 833-937-4968 or 833-WE-ARE-FOR-YOU.
Remember, you can hear the Rosary every day here on Catholic Radio Indy at 5:30 a.m. and at 9:30 p.m.
Welcome once again to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here, and we're talking about abortion, and we're talking about the cultural roots of abortion, where abortion came from. We're about ready to celebrate the anniversary. Celebrate's probably not the right word. Mark is probably a better word. Commemorate the anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision, which struck down states' abilities to outlaw abortion. And it basically foisted a regime of legalized abortion on our country for 50 years. The cultural effects of that, we're going to have to unravel and deal with for several generations. This is not going to be easy to recover from, but at least the healing can now begin. And part of that healing, though, I think, is going back and looking at the cultural roots of where abortion came from, because abortion is unfortunately deeply intertwined in our national fabric. As I was just talking about the last segment, abortion and the eugenics idea, the idea of breeding out certain undesirables out of our population, is intimately connected to slavery and the legacy, the negative legacy that slavery has left in our culture. And it's also connected to feminism and the liberation of women from the 19th century mentality that pervaded, that basically kind of said, you know, look, there's a good side and a bad side to this. It said, you know, look, women are part of a family unit, and so women's, to a certain extent, status and place within society is dependent on her role within the family. And so there was a movement to break free of that, and through the suffrage movement. And the suffrage movement really happened because of men falling down on their responsibilities as husbands. You had our country when it was founded was largely agrarian. So when people came to this country, they came with the promise of land, they came with the promise of being able to farmstead, of have a workable area of land that was their own. And they weren't really able, as sort of the peasant class in Europe, to be able to do this. They were working other people's land. And so America was a land of promise with ample resources, ample land for people to come here, form a new way of life. And that new way of life, more often than not, meant farming. And it meant moving to places like Indiana and clearing the land of the timber and, you know, establishing your family as a farming family. And so that was a familial endeavor. Any farming family now will tell you farming is a familial endeavor. It involves the whole family working in concert, working for the common good of the family as a whole. Well, the Industrial Revolution happened pretty close to when we broke away from England and established our independence from colonies. And with the Industrial Revolution, suddenly there was a need for workers in the cities. There was a need for workers in the factories. And so what had once been farm families moved to the cities to become industrial families, to become families where their money was made through work in factories. And with that, there became a division of labor between producing for somebody else in a factory and running a household. And both were full-time jobs. So, before the advent of washing machines, before the advent of dishwashers, before the advent of vacuum cleaners, the running of a household, even a small apartment, was a full-time job. And then you add to that the education of children on top of that. And all that's involved with that, there became a division of labor where men were working outside of the home, usually at factories and that kind of thing, and women were left to take care of all of the housework. On a farm, and I think any farming family will tell you this, at a farm, that division of labor, whether you're working out in the field or whether you're working in the house, that is much more fluid, right? And the tasks that are involved with that are much more familial. They're much more divided as a household, and the whole household has to take care of those. When you divide them up artificially, you wind up with men's world and women's world. And when you wound up with men's world that was in the factories, and then entertainment after that with your work buddies and all of that, it really left women confined to the household, to taking care of the children, to taking care of laundry, to being almost a live-in servant for the man. And that led to even further abuse. And so as the Industrial Revolution progressed, there were crises of alcoholism. There were crises of domestic abuse. There were multiple crises that originated from this split of labor that happened when people moved off the farm and into the cities. And so the suffrage movement arose, the women's rights movement arose, to give women the right to vote, to give women a rightful place in society, to give women a voice so that their needs could be met, so that they could have an equal voice to the men who had in a lot of ways abandoned their families. Some of that as a result of their jobs being in factories away from the household, but some of that due to immorality, some of that due to weakness of character, some of that to vice and a lack of virtue. And the women arose to call that out. And so the suffrage movement arose as a feminist movement to sort of try to restore the balance in family life. And the original feminists were very much against abortion. They saw abortion as a tool that was used, and I think rightly, and I think this has always been the case with abortion, a tool that was used by immoral men to be able to shirk their responsibilities. And so women were left with the responsibility of bearing and raising children, and a man who impregnated a woman, basically he would use abortion to say, hey, look, it's your choice, right? You can raise this child as your own. You can go ahead and abort it and utilize abortion. Either way, though, it's not my responsibility. It's your responsibility. So abortion really became a tool to oppress women. And the early suffragists, the early women's rights advocates, the early feminists, they saw this. They got this. You go back and you look at the writings of Susan B. Anthony. You look at the speeches of the early feminists, and most of them address abortion. And most of them address abortion as we're pro-life, right? You can't separate us from the child we're bearing, and men need to take a role and responsibility in raising children. And so there was an attempt to restore that balance of family. Well, as time progressed and you had birth control introduced and the widespread social acceptance of birth control, this attitude within the feminist movement shifted. And, you know, I think that happened in a large degree because of the acceptance of birth control. You know, birth control has throughout the majority of history of Christianity been seen as something that is immoral because it separates and divides man from woman. It interferes with the natural process of marital relations. You know, marital relations are there for two purposes. They're there to bring about children, and they're there to bond men to women. And birth control, no matter what kind of birth control, interferes with both of those. It obviously keeps men and women from cooperating with God in the bringing about of new children. That's kind of its intended effect. But it also keeps men and women from being able to bond together. And science is interesting in this respect. I think we're just now beginning to scientifically unpack what the hormones involved in the birth control pill do chemically, that keep men and women separate, that disrupt the natural bonding that sexual relations are supposed to have between a husband and a wife. We're just now beginning to understand how birth control interferes with that. But, you know, the church has always kind of seen it. The church has always stood against birth control for these reasons, not for the reasons that the society says that, you know, somehow birth control is a tool of the patriarchy to try to keep women in bondage. Quite the opposite, when you look at it, historically happened. As birth control came onto the scene, women were more and more seen as almost household slaves to a certain extent. And you didn't have that division until birth control came on the scene. So, you know, the Catholic Church has always stood against abortion, and the Protestant Church, not only abortion, but birth control as well. And the Protestant churches, for most of their history, recognized the dangers of birth control as well. It wasn't until the 1930s with the Lambeth Conference, where the Anglican congregation kind of came together and they said, look, we're hearing that there are some benefits from the workers, and that this was coming out of the socialist movement. We hear that there's benefits for the working class of being able to control the number of children that a couple has. And so because of that, you know, we're going to change, and we're going to do an about face on what had been the Christian position on birth control up until the 1930s. And so the Anglicans sort of paved the way, and with that, other Protestant denominations began to fall in line. Until when you get to 1973, when the Roe versus Wade decision came down, the Catholic Church was the only remaining Christian group that recognized the dangers of birth control and recognized the connection of birth control to abortion. Yeah, I think that was one of the shocks that occurred to the American public when Roe versus Wade was decided. And the shock was abortion quickly became backup birth control, the connection there. And the Casey decision, when you look at you read the preamble to the Casey Supreme Court decision, the Supreme Court even recognized that and said, look, basically, as long as there's birth control, there's going to have to be abortion as a backup to it. And so that was their justification for continuing to keep states from being able to regulate abortion up until the Dobbs decision. So, you know, this strain of feminism quickly became, to a certain extent, hijacked by this movement for birth control, for this movement of liberation from women from childbearing. And that was never the intention of the early feminists. And so, you know, a lot of what the early feminists stood for, this repairing of the fabric of the family, we've never undergone. We've never been able to do that as a society because of birth control and abortion. And so part of this looking at what it means to repair tear our culture from abortion, is to revisit that and kind of look at what does it take to repair the fabric of our society, to bring back the idea of a husband and wife as partners in life, working through this industrial and post-industrial society as a unit where the division of labor is not split. Technology's helped. The amount of labor that it takes to run a household is now half of what it used to be in the 1950s, just with dishwashers and washing machines and those types of things. The technology has made the ability to do household work much easier. And in that way, it has allowed, I think, that fair division of labor to begin to be restored. Yes, statistics still say that women still do the bulk of household work, but I think that's beginning to change. I think men and women are beginning to divide that up more evenly, and certainly because it takes less time now, women are much more liberated, I think, to be out in the workplace and to have careers. But there's still that division. There's still that divide between husband and wife and career. And you have gurus out there trying to talk about work-life balance because we've split up life into all of these different spheres. And part of the restoration that's going to have to happen for us to build a culture of life is going to be repairing that fabric of spiritual and family and societal life so that we are living integrated whole lives again. That integration, I think that's a topic for another Catholic Cave when I've got Joseph here and I've got Tim here to bounce ideas off of. But I definitely see that is intimately connected now to pro-life work, to restoring a culture of life and to healing the wounds that have been caused by half a century of abortion. We're coming up on a break. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back here on the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Real radio for a messed up world. Real grace for people who've lost their way. Real love from the heart of God. Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, and I am talking about restoring a culture of life. And we've spent this show going back and looking at sort of the historic roots of abortion. And I see the two biggest roots. There's actually lots of them, but the two biggest ones in our culture's history are the eugenics movement that came out of the Civil War, that are connected to race relations and will continue to be connected to race relations. And this feminist movement that came out of the breakdown of the family when we shifted from being an agrarian society to being an industrial society. And those two strains led to the acceptance of birth control, and with the acceptance of birth control, eventually the use of abortion as sort of backup birth control. And so by the time we got to 1973, our society had been practicing both of these. There had been, birth control had been accepted en masse by our culture. And then abortion was being utilized more and more as a backup. And so there were more and more women who were being flown to New York, who were being flown to California, where it had been legalized piecemeal by the time you had the Roe versus Wade decision in 1973. And so with 1973 and the Roe versus Wade decision, the Supreme Court just basically gave a green light for what had been building within our culture for close to a century before that. And that opened up the floodgates. And suddenly now you had what had been sort of under the surface was allowed to be out on top of the surface. And so 1973 was connected intimately with the sexual revolution. And the sexual revolution carried on into the 70s, and you just had a complete breakdown in even the idea of marriage. So marriage had been seen by the feminists as something that needed to be repaired. With birth control, with the move and continued, I think, division of labor between households household work and work, working outside of the house for men. Suddenly, the idea of liberation came. Well, women can work outside of the home now. And when women could work outside of the home, then the idea came that, well, this idea of marriage where you've got a partnership between a man and a woman, it's just simply that. It's just simply a co-partnership. There's nothing more to it than that. And so the idea of marriage itself started to break down. And so you, in the 1970s, you began to have a culture of promiscuity arise. And that continued from the 1970s into the 1980s. And it really culminated about the time I graduated from high school. I'm going to age myself a little bit here, in the early 1990s. The year I graduated from high school in 1991, that was the high point of just about every social pathology you can imagine. That was the high point, until recently, unfortunately, of teen suicide. That was the high point of teen drug use. That was the high point of teen alcohol use. That was the high point of teen promiscuity. It was about the high point of abortion numbers nationally. It was unfortunately, it was like the crest of the wave of this massive, almost two century long movement that had led to that point. And it came crashing down socially, I think, in the mid to late 90s and the early 2000s. And I think with that crash, you started to see people really start to reconsider this culture that we had built over, post-industrial revolution, this culture that we had built in the United States where marriage was seen as a secondary or tertiary project to your main role in life, which was tied to your job. I think people really began to question that idea. They really began to question the health of multiple sexual partners and the unhealthy sexual lifestyles that had emerged. They started to notice all of the people that had been left behind in this. We started to have huge homeless problems in this country. We started to recognize the damage that was done to children when they were kind of left behind as adults pursued their own interests. It was in elementary school and early middle school. I was part of that whole latch kid phenomenon that, I think the psychological damage on that entire generation from, in some ways, what amounted to parental abandonment, we're still unpacking. And we're still unpacking that by the way we've raised our kids, which isn't always perfect. And so I think there's the rise of psychology and psychiatry trying to deal with these traumatic events. You go back and you look at the generation that came of age in the 1930s and 1940s. They had traumas of war. They had traumas of being refugees. There was a lot of traumatic events, but they weren't the trauma of societal and familial breakdown that we're having to deal with now. And so I think a lot of building a culture of life is going back and reckoning with that. But I think from the pro-life movement's perspective, as we're talking about building a culture of life, the most important work that we have right now is building a welcoming society for pregnant moms and their babies. Abortion was a recourse for women for decades because they felt abandoned by society when they conceived a child out of wedlock. Our society looked down on that and didn't recognize this as a societal-wide pattern that we were all playing a part in and that we continue to all play a part in. And so part of the restitution is really reaching out to those single women, really the single moms, really reaching out to the children that are born outside of wedlock and recognizing they need some extra help right now. They need some extra intervention from us society-wide while we're going about restoring the institution of the family, which is really where children are meant to be brought into this world. Every child deserves both a mom and a dad who are there, who are present, who are raising them, who are active in their lives as a mom and a dad within a marriage. That's what every child deserves. You know, unfortunately, I think the stats say it's a minority of children in our culture that actually have that, that have a marriage of mom and dad with their original children intact. That's a minority now. And until we're able to restore a culture where that is the norm again, we're going to have to reach out to the families where that's not a norm. And we're going to have to kind of help provide them with the things that they need to be able to get a leg up, to be able to thrive so that their children can eventually create that. That's what it means right now, I think, for restoring a culture of life, is to really put into practice that, that phrase that we've been talking about the last few years of love them both. Make sure that both mom and baby are loved by our society, and make sure that we create a culture where both mom and baby can thrive. So as we're marching and people are asking, on January 22nd, Roe versus Wade was overturned, why are we still marching? We are marching for a culture of life. We are marching to restore a society where both mom and baby are seen as valuable members of our society. They're recognized for the dignity that they have. And we're working towards creating a culture where families are intact and moms and babies both have their rightful place within our society. That is what we're marching. You've been listening to here on The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed by calling 317-870-8400.